Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project gets underway. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, your opportunity to hear a half hour of commentary, analysis, and perhaps even, if we're extremely thoughtful and lucky, some insight into the media issues of the week. Media, I say, not meaty issues, but that perhaps too. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, your putative host here. Here is Stu Shinsky, the executive editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal.
Hello, guys.
Hey, wonderful to see you. And Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, columnist, commentator, professor emeritus, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I have to say, the Times Union, which you run, Rex, is a good paper, but you guys have really been distinguishing yourself day after day with all of the great stuff that has been coming out about the misdoings of, I think, the governor of New York and the people who surround him.
Well, congratulations to you. Thank you very much. I mean, actually, it does fit into, and you, did you see me slip the cash under the table, Stu?
It was a big stack, too.
Of ones.
How'd you get all that in your wallet? Oh, wait, it was a box.
Coney Island bankroll is what it is, yeah. But it does slip into media issues here having to do with truth-telling or with fact-checking, which we'll get to in a minute on the presidential debate. But, you know, here's an interesting case. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, finally at a public event was asked by reporters, what about all of this corruption in your office? And he said, well, actually, it's not my office. It's the SUNY purchasing business. And you know, the responsibility of the reporter then, which I'm pleased to say our reporters did, was to say next, actually, in the cover, you say, actually, the counts of corruption alleged by the U.S. prosecutor, Preet Bharara, do involve a lot of stuff right in the executive chamber of the governor.
Certainly his best does. Friends, what are we talking
Certainly
about here?
Does.
We're talking about the third, and by his own words, the third son of Mario Cuomo, the most favored, he said, which was Joe Pococo, and Todd Howe, his closest guy who's been with him all this time. And now he has the nerve, I mean the nerve, to say that Catherine Deneuve.
only in that accent would just Deneuve sound like
delivered
nerve,
perfectly,
you know?
Like, too. Perfectly.
The nerve to say it was on SUNY. Look, this guy comes along, he grabs SUNY, he makes it an ancillary of his office. He demands that his economic development plans, he's going to put in anybody can go onto a SUNY campus, or not anybody, but people can go onto a SUNY campus and they can start a business and they won't pay taxes for 10 years. What is he talking about that he has nothing to do with SUNY? They were doing his bidding.
No one was in those positions that the governor didn't know about. And they weren't there if he didn't want them there.
So it is important for reporters covering this to not just, as some people always say, you know, they just tell me the facts and let me make up my mind. Yes, that's fine. But the facts then sometimes have to be pointed out by reporters when the asserted facts by politicians do not square with reality, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I think you guys deserve a Pulitzer for this work. I do.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Wow.
Or
we'll see.
A thank you letter from Catherine Deneuve.
At least. I loved her. I thought she was fabulous.
Me too. Of course, we're not millennials. And millennials now figure into all of this thing. Mm-hmm. As you remember last week, Rex, we had a group in.
High school seniors.
And we asked them who reads the newspaper, and not one hand went up. So things are changing.
Well, again, if you want to repeat last week's show, I would point out that they read content digitally and they just don't know that it's newspaper content that they're reading. And I don't care if they don't read the print version of the paper. I want them to read our content.
Absolutely, Rex. You're exactly right. But there's no reason to get defensive.
Right, because we know that those high school seniors are all listening to public radio instead.
And they should be. And by the way.
It's time for study hall, kids. You got to stop listening now. Go to study hall.
By the way, that's as much our problem as it is yours.
Exactly. So about fact checking, because that's what we were really talking about in the context of the charges, the federal charges filed against state officials and hangers on. One question about the presidential debate, the first debate, was that there were two kinds of fact-checking going on. On stage, Lester Holt saying what was reality, and then there were real-time fact-checkers. NPR, for example, was one of the news organizations that had real-time
great
fact-checking
job
going
they did.
On. Yeah.
We've been getting a lot of mail on this, Rex, and there have been many proposals made for how to do this right. One of them, which I thought was very clever, is that when you tell your first lie, you get a small shock. You tell your second lie, you get a bigger shock. And zappo when you tell your third lie during this time. But it really does raise the question, as NPR did, whether or not a CNN or an MSNBC would be in a position to say, that's a lie. The scrawl underneath, that's a lie.
Why can't they put it right on the screen?
Yeah.
I mean, have a team assembled as NPR did. I don't know. Maybe there's no way to do it, but there's got to be a way to put
well, if NPR could do it, they could do it.
It could be done. It should be done. And it's such a valuable service to take the rhetoric and convert it into accurate context because, you know, as entertaining as the debate was, I mean, I stopped counting the things that I thought were untrue.
I think the difficulty is when you put it on the screen, it's so context takes a lot of words.
Yes.
And that's why it's ideal to have it on your second screen, on your tablet that mm-hmm. you're holding. Mm-hmm. And so many people were holding a tablet.
Yeah, I was.
A lot of people, of course, watching a Twitter feed or else doing the reading the fact-checking. Now we have the technology because we have multiple screens available to us, and it is a great thing to do in real time.
Well, then, you know what? Extend the debate for 15 minutes, and every 15 minutes in the debate, stop for 1 minute and put stuff on the screen. Do like they do in football where it's in quarters or something uh-huh. like that. And just put it in there because it's to me, it's so essential to get the accurate information out there. And you know what? If you're watching it, you might have your laptop or your iPad or whatever, but just put it where you're watching it. We mm-hmm. should be able to do this.
You know, meanwhile, during the debate, Lester Holt a couple of times did say, actually, Mr. Stuck
Trump. It to him.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that's not true.
That's not accurate,
He didn't actually use the word, I'm sorry, I'm losing the exact phrasing, but it was in the context of was he or was he not asserting
was
before
he or not
the Iraq
telling
war.
A big fat lie.
Yeah.
And by the way, I know that both of you guys, right, you run Gary Trudeau, don't you?
Yes, we do.
And last week,
he
did one of the best things I've ever seen, because sometimes it gets so obscure, his column, that I can't really follow it. However, this time it said, you get one Pinocchio, in other words, a big, you know. So he said, Hillary told a lie about it. The first one, last week's, was about Hillary told a lie, so she gets one Pinocchio. And then she says, next week, and you see about a dozen Pinocchio noses coming
right.
at you, but he doesn't even say what's going to be next week.
Yeah, you know who it's going to be. In any case, I thought that that was a useful tool on the part of the news organizations to do that, and good work by Lester Holt. 60% of Americans, according to Monmouth University polling, say yes, there should be fact-checking by debate moderators.
Please.
Go ahead.
No,
I
insist.
You know,
Alphonse,
guys. Okay, I got the up microphone, boys. Stand back. you know, I got to tell you, I was not impressed by Lester Holt. I really wasn't. But I don't think it's his fault, because when they choose the moderators for these things, the candidates have to agree. Okay, they have to agree, and they probably have to agree on what the role of the moderator is. And I think we could have had a 10th grader from your local high school sit there and ask the questions that Lester asked. Some very important person can come up with them. Anyone can ask the questions. But is the role of the moderator to basically be that third person, or is it someone to hone in on the inaccuracies, provide the context? I still think, and I think I've said this on this show before with the primary debates, if they have 2 minutes, turn the danged microphones off at the two-minute mark. Because to me, Lester had a difficult task. And frankly, I think it just came down to, yes, he asked questions. He had a couple of corrections in there, not many. But you know what? It's really for the candidate. So do you want a strong moderator or not?
I gave him an A. And I know most of America did not. So that while Rex is right about the percentages, the moderator did not get that strong a thing, because the liberals, the ones who write letters, dirty letters to me, all said he didn't go far enough, pretty much as you've just done. And then the right wingers all said he was incredibly in favor of Hillary.
Right.
Yeah. So this is a very
tough
job.
I think he did very well. I liked actually the format of this debate, which gave the opportunity for them to go back and forth. You know, there was a longer, it wasn't so much everything has to be said in 60-second bites, which lends itself to memorization of key points. And this,
which
actually,
she did and he didn't.
Well, she did, but it also showed that she can think on her feet.
But it also showed she was disciplined, and he is not disciplined, and that's what he's getting held for.
But he was the guy who, Lester Holt was the guy who said when Donald, on the third time around, when Trump said, I was against the war, wait a minute, I was against the war in Iraq, he said, the record shows otherwise, said Lester Holt. And I think that is the right thing for him to do. So,
but could he, if the format allowed, have had an expanded role in doing that? And this is more of a theoretical question about the role of the moderator instead of Lester Holt. And frankly, maybe you go 2 hours or 2.5 hours with it and you work that in. But I just think the moderator should do more than sit there and ask questions and pipe in occasionally.
Well, another thing about the lies is when Donald Trump was done, the reporters asked him, how did Lester do? And he said, good. He was good.
Until the next day when he changed his tune.
Until the next day when the advisors got a hold of him and said, you did what?
You can't compliment the moderator.
Yeah.
You have to attack exactly. Yeah.
And the microphone.
Yeah, you can't compliment the media, Mr. Trump.
Yeah, right. Nothing good about the media. It's all. Of course, you know, Mr. Trump does quote the mainstream media when it's
convenient.
To his advantage. Yes, absolutely. Yes. 80 million people watched that debate. So
a lot of people
started.
Not as many as the Super Bowl, but similar entertainment.
Yeah, that's true.
Or as the New York Times said, Super Bowl territory.
Yeah.
Yes, it was close.
So
let me just say that I got a letter.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kind of thing that makes those of us who are sensitive people.
Sensitive people. Yeah, thin-skinned, you and Donald Trump. Huh?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Makes us a little crazy. So a woman wrote and she said, if Mr. Shartok watched the debate, you know, if he didn't watch the debate, he should say so. And we all know what time he gets up in the morning, 2:30 in the morning.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So I wrote her back and said, dear madam, you're right. However, I have to tell you, I went to bed at 6. I woke up at 9. I watched the entire debate. And then I went back to sleep. She wrote back and she said, you know, she was still on her high horse. And I said, now, look, to myself anyway, you were calling me a liar. I told you the truth. What is your problem? People have opinions, and then they shove them down your throat.
Let the record reflect that Dr. Shartok watched the debate.
Every
so that he could speak
minute
with authority
of it.
You could have broken out that journalism phrase, poppycock.
There you go.
Yeah.
By the way, while we're on the presidential race, interesting phenomenon going on. Newspapers that have never before endorsed a Democrat are doing so.
Yeah.
The Arizona Republic, which in its 100-year history had never endorsed a Democrat, has endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Which used to be called the Arizona Republican, but they changed it to Republic.
The Republic.
That happens
Arizona
to a lot of newspapers. I used to be the editor of a paper called The Republican, and in Rensselaer, Indiana, the Rensselaer Republican, it was called.
Did they change the name?
No, it's still called that. A lot of papers around the country, Waterbury Republican.
Is it Plattsburgh and Springfield?
Press Republican, yes. It's because, of course, a lot of these papers, well, because in the 19th century, you know, newspapers were overtly biased, intentionally created by political parties to support each other.
And still do it. But
in my case, in Indiana, the editor, the owner of the Rensselaer Republican, bought the competition, so he owned the Jasper County Democrat also. So the Republicans bought out the Democrats. It's all
and, of course, remember back in the 1850s and so, the Republicans had a very respectable party. Abraham Lincoln was the president of the United States. Nothing to be ashamed of there.
It'd be the 60s, of course, not the 1850s.
It was 50s, 60s.
56. 56 was the first year they ran a presidential candidate. Yeah. John Fremont. But we were about to say,
oh, how impressive.
Yeah, very good. The Cincinnati Inquirer. Here's Dallas Morning News, the Houston Chronicle. From my, though they have been back and forth, they have not been exclusively endorsing Republicans for years. That's from my company, Hearst. So does it make any difference? Do we think this matters at all?
Yeah, we've been having this discussion in our newsroom as recently as yesterday afternoon as we record this. And we don't know what we're going to do yet. Not necessarily who we might endorse, but whether we endorse, because, you know, the Poughkeepsie Journal media endorsement is not going to tilt the world off of its axis. We understand that. But both candidates have flaws. Both candidates maybe have attributes. So we're wondering, you know,
are you kidding? I mean, you have to stack up their flaws and attributes against each other. And I don't think there's much question about your responsibility here, Stuart.
Mm-hmm.
Your responsibility is obviously to endorse Hillary Clinton.
But is it our responsibility to endorse? Do they still work? Are they as powerful as
they used to be? Well, what's the difference? There is the right thing and the wrong thing here.
There is.
There's a column by Margaret Sullivan in the Washington Post. Margaret Sullivan, formerly the editor of the Buffalo News and then the public editor of the New York Times, now a Washington Post media writer. She actually cited a couple of academic studies. And as we all know, with Dr. Chartok in the room,
the only man with a PhD in the room.
These people know what they're talking about.
Yes, knows Catherine's enough. Yes.
They know whereof they speak. She cited a couple of academic studies that purport to show that a newspaper endorsement can matter in an instance where a newspaper steps outside its usual role. So, for example, it makes no difference if the Times Union endorses Hillary Clinton because everybody expects us to do so. That is our typical stance. We endorsed Barack Obama. We endorsed John Kerry. But for the Arizona Republic, it really could make a difference to those folks in Arizona.
That was a seismic change, yes.
Right. And by the way, it made NPR in the next morning. You're exactly right. Dog bites man, forget it. Man bites dog, you got something different.
Okay. So we need to talk about climate change. Here's a surprise. A gentleman, I don't think we've had any opportunity to speak about talking about climate change, but this is a new little bit of information. Fox News apparently is being pushed to change its reporting on climate change. Fox News's reporting on climate change is often very different from all the other media. Its hosts say that the science is still in question, and that warnings about climate change are from people aligned with the left. And now apparently there's been an effort because James Murdoch, right,
Rupert,
has said that he supports the notion of climate change. His father does not. And the question is, what is the appropriate role of the media in reporting about climate change here?
I'm going to change the subject for a second, a little bit.
Never mind.
Rexy.
So don't answer my question.
Not just
have
climate change, but change overall.
We got that one taken care of. Okay, what's that?
But I have often said that the people sitting at the top, the ownership, dictates what's going to be basically the approach of the paper. Now, I believe that the Murdoch kids are to the left somewhat, or moderate, from the old man. And I think they're in control right now. So we see, for example, that some of the old Roger Ailes allies on the POST, a name which I will never pronounce if I can avoid it, they're not there anymore. They're going. Slowly, this place is changing its attitude
based on
the ownership of the paper or the control of the paper. Don't you see?
Don't you? Well, that could be happening. I think that at Fox, it is different from other companies. We're talking about and so that's why it makes a difference. You would not find the ownership of my company, for example, telling an editor to say, here's how you cover climate change.
But you would have in the old days.
Well, yeah. Again, 50 years ago, you certainly would.
Yeah, and I'm that old. So.
Wow.
Well, we got that from the Catherine Deneuve reference.
Lovely. But
I enjoyed it.
So what happens is these are news organizations that mature, Rex. You're exactly right. And when they do, maybe control or how the editorial position is established changes. I mean, what was that New Hampshire paper? They were terrible all those years, you know. I mean, so right-wing.
Union Leader.
And I think they've modified their stance somewhat. So when an organization like Hearst, which used to run the old man's column, as I remember it, right above the paper on Sundays, that's not there anymore. And so things change, is my point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the days of family generations owning papers, I mean, Hearst is maybe the last. On the bigger scale. I mean, there's certainly family-held papers out there.
There is also the Newhouse family controls Condé Nast and Advanced Publications.
Okay.
So they have Syracuse and
Newark Star Ledger.
And one of
Cincinnati.
Your competitors, Rex, the Schenectady paper, is still owned by a family.
Still family.
Right. It's a smaller. He was talking about the scale.
Yeah, no, but
yeah,
the
empire.
Independent. And now the Berkshire Eagle is now an independent. Right. Own paper, right. That kind of thing. So there is some of that going on. Right. Philadelphia, actually, the two newspapers and single website in Philadelphia now are owned by a not-for-profit. So that is in local hands. That has really changed. So anyway, the question, though, is it appropriate for journalists to step in and say, we're not going to, I guess I'm answering my own question. It's appropriate for us to say we're not going to give equal weight to the climate change skeptics that we give to science. Journalism needs to stand on the side of science.
False equivalency.
Yes, exactly. You know, 10 years ago, I remember writing a note to our reporters saying, you, on this issue, you need to not be swayed by this notion of false equivalency.
I want to report that I am a columnist for the Berkshire Eagle, and the Berkshire Eagle has just made a decision we've been talking about on and off here for many months, and that is not to allow the trolls to come in at the end and do comments.
Really?
At the end of stories.
At the end of stories. You want to write a you want to write a letter? Good. We'll consider your letter. Sign your name. We'll consider your letter. The right thing to do. But there is a handful of real meanies out there who do nothing but, you know, test the limits of how nasty they can be. And it doesn't really do anything for public education.
Well, the comments probably are just going to move to a Facebook page or a social media feed. And will those trolls have to use their real name, which in Facebook you pretty much have to for the most part? So are they anonymous when they post those comments on the stories, or are they using their real name?
Oh, I wish I could tell you.
Probably hiding behind, you know, like ham sandwich is their handle or something.
But it's an interesting debate because, as Stu points out, if you don't host the comments will be there somewhere else.
Yeah, but where's the somewhere else?
It's usually Facebook.
Facebook is one place, but Facebook, you have to have friends who you send this stuff to. So how many friends do you have? Does it get the same distribution, and is it as concentrated? If you take a look at the Berkshire Eagle, it is the county newspaper.
Right, but if you comment on Facebook, because every newsroom, our newsroom, Rex's newsroom, just about every newsroom, they're putting their stories on Facebook because, frankly, a lot of people aren't going to the website. The direct feed from social. So the comments, if I put a comment on a story that's on Facebook, anyone can see it who it likes the Berkshire Eagle feed or likes the Poughkeepsie Journal feed. So it's not just friends who will see it. It'll be out there just as it was on the website.
Mm-hmm. I see your point.
Yeah.
Which means, I don't agree with you, sir. But I see you.
Interesting. But on climate change, yeah, it is one of those sort of, you know, if it's wrong, it's wrong. But you're right. The debaters will definitely say, well, how come you're not giving us a voice? And then you have that old empirical thing where you're censoring us, which isn't necessarily the case.
Oh, boy. No. Censoring.
But it is interesting. Two old ladies sitting on the boardwalk, and one says to the other, my son sent me to finishing school to learn how to speak better. Well, give me an example of something you got taught there. I got taught to say interesting rather than BS.
Sorry.
That's well worth the tuition.
This can be hazardous. You can actually have people catch you. I have a habit of saying amazing when people say something. That is a sort of a reaction. And I had a lovely older lady who was telling me about growing up poor. And she said, you know, I was a skinny little girl. They had to give me extra milk in school because I was so skinny. And I wasn't paying attention. And I just said, amazing. And she said, well, she's rather stout. She said, well, it's not that amazing that I was skinny. That was a terrible moment. I'm still sorry.
No, we won't get into those. Right?
No, let's not do that. We say things that we don't intend to say.
No.
So Michiko Kakutani is a book reviewer for the New York Times who has just written a review of a book about Hitler and has never once in the review mentioned the name of Donald Trump. A brilliant thing.
But when you read the coming attractions on that book, you had to unsee that there was a real parallel.
Exactly. And that gets shared socially. I mean, Stu, you're probably pushing your content on social media. That is, you're figuring out a way to try to get more eyeballs.
Millions of referrals a year to our content from Facebook.
Yeah.
A month, actually.
And what happens if Facebook changes its mode?
The ever popular algorithm Alan enjoys so much.
Yes. Yeah. Algorithm.
The algorithm. You might have heard of him. He's
not Alcor.
Yes. But if Facebook basically changes the software, sort of the directions of the software, that would stop that or limit the news, which has come up where they want to limit some news feeds.
And they want you to buy your advertising. I mean, what happens is we get things on Facebook and it says you could have had more people
the post.
Yes, sure.
Yeah. So, but if Facebook changed that, that would definitely be a hit, a reduction in traffic. But the question also would be, what do you want to pay? They basically are saying, you know what, you give us $30, we'll reach 6,000 more people for you in the next 20 minutes. So Facebook's
going to
stay on the revenue side.
The world is changing. And on that point, quote of the week, actually, media critic Dylan Byers says, quote, conservatives say media is biased against Trump. Given everything that he's said and done, it's actually remarkable how fair they've been. There you go. How about that?
Well said.
That's all for the Media Project. Dr. Alan Shartok, Stu Shinsky, and Rex Smith here. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.
I'll be looking forward, Stewie, to see who you endorse in this campaign.
It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.